todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by veteran music journalist and author Daniel Buxban, who brings with him an impressive 30 years of experience covering the world of rock and beyond. Dan is here to talk about his latest book, Rush at 50, a celebration of one of the most beloved and enduring bands in rock history. This hardcover treasure takes us through 50 milestone moments from Rush's incredible career, and we will learn more about this book and a lot more in just a moment. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast.
Whoa, thank you for having me.
Well, I read your book and I absolutely loved it. It's such a great visual experience. And I want to kind of dive into your process in writing it, because Rush does have such a unique sound and their legacy differs from their hard rock contemporaries. What was your introduction to the band and what inspired you to write Rush at 50?
Well, my introduction to the band was in the 1980s when I was a teenager in high school, and they were on MTV, and there were videos for The Big Money on Power Windows and Distant Early Warning on Grace Under Pressure. And I liked them, but it just not quite to the point where it was like, I must run outside and buy these records immediately. Not long after that, I heard the song Free Will and the amazing guitar solo by Alex Lifeson comes up, and that was it. I got hooked right at that moment, and that was many decades ago, and they became one of my favorite bands, like, very quickly. And, you know, to this day, even though I've heard the entire catalog thousands of times, they still have the same effect on me as the first time I heard them. They just, when the music starts, I have sort of like an involuntary response to it. It's a positive one. But there, you know, there's a lot of music I've been listening to for a long time. Like, after a while, it runs out. You kind of maybe lose interest in it, or you move on to something else. This has never happened to me with Rush, ever. No matter what else I was listening to at the time, no matter what phase in my life it was just always there. And it was very easy to, you know, keep it with me through life, because it's just always had this effect on me. The music has always been relevant. The lyrics have always been relevant. And every time I go back and listen, I kind of get something new out of it every time. There are just not a lot of bands you can say that about. Maybe the Beatles, maybe David Bowie, you know, where the point was with every record to change and not repeat what had come before. There's just not a lot of that out there. But I think Artists like that give a lot of lasting value to listeners by always wanting to come up with something new and change the formula. In Rush's case, that was very important to them. That was like the mission, was we must always evolve. We must always deviate from the norm, you might say. And they always did. And just between that and, the extremely high level of musicianship and the songwriting, and there are a lot of reasons to keep them in your life forever, you know?
Well, before reading your book, I listened to on audiobook Geddy Lee's autobiography, My Effin' Life, which was just so fun and really taught me a lot about his philosophy, the band's impetus to change, like you said. I'm wondering if you read it while working on your book, or did it influence any of your own writing or perspectives?
I really was making a point of trying to steer clear of, anything those guys had written, and trying not to duplicate what had been written by other writers before me, who have also written on this topic. Some quotes from My Effin' Life actually made it into my book, so I was able to, take some of it. But for the most, for the most part, I was really cognizant of the fact that there are a lot of books out there about these guys. Some of them written by the band members. And, whoever you are, you will never write a more authoritative book about Geddy Lee than Geddy Lee did. You will never write a more authoritative book about Rush than the members did. And you were asking sort of like what my kind of what my process was and what my goal was. And early on, I was like, I can't really, there's so much good stuff out there already that I am not going to compete with it. I'm not going to compare myself to it. I'm going to let that be over there and just make this a book about my experience with this band and my feelings about this band, and just make it personal. And I guess in that I have gotten all kinds of feedback about that, good and bad. But I feel like what we have to say as individual people, that's how you make it unique. That's how you don't duplicate what's out there. You talk about how it means, what it means to you and how it makes you feel. No one else can really copy that. And again, like I said, there were some people who did not want that at all. They just wanted like, here's what happened. But I really felt like, for a band like this, who were extremely creative, not afraid to maybe alienate some of their listeners. They're really creativity first. I felt like it made sense to write the book in the same way and lead with that and lead with what they are to me emotionally. Which a lot of writers don't want to put out there. But these guys have just meant so much to me over the years and have done so much for me just as a listener that it made sense to me to do it that way.
Well, that's what I liked about your book, and it does set it apart from others, because if someone wants the basic facts, they can get that in another book. Also, your book is so beautifully illustrated with the gatefolds and everything. I mean, that it just makes it really special. Did you have a hand in curating the imagery, or did you have help with that? How does that work? Because that's a major undertaking.
All of that, 100% of the credit for that must go to Quarto Motor Books, who handled all of that. The only thing with image sourcing that I had any involvement in was that we interviewed the engineer who worked on the Presto album, and he took his own personal photos during the sessions, and he shared a couple of them with us, which he had never done that before. We've got that. That's a little special. I don't think anyone else has that. But for the most part, like the memorabilia and, all the stuff that you're talking about, that was Dennis and Quarto, and they deserve all the credit for that.
What was the feeling when you first held the hardcover in your hands and got to look at it?
Well, I mean, it's really funny because, you spend time, a lot of really intense time in the middle of this project. It's your whole life for a while. Then, you check the proofs and make sure everything looks okay, and then you move on to the next thing, and you actually kind of forget about it. Like I've been in the middle of writing another book for a few months now. And my mind was really on that. Then this came out. I opened the box. That will always be the most surreal feeling in the world when you open a box and there's like 10 books with your name on it, you know. It I don't know, it almost feels like a gag in some ways, like, oh, who did this? Come on, you know. But you know, I'm flipping through it and I'm like, oh, right, I said that. Oh, right, I forgot about that, you know. But I mean, when I first saw it, I did an unboxing video with my son, and it was just, I was so happy with the way it came out and just so proud to be involved with something that looks that good. You know, it almost pains me on these interviews when people ask me about, you know, the design of the book. It almost pains me to not be able to give myself credit for that because I had nothing to do with it. I would love to take credit for that, though. Oh my God, that would be glorious.
It's a fantastic collaboration. They really offset your words with some great visuals. For those who haven't read the book yet, did you ever get a chance to meet any of the members of Rush through your career in journalism?
I specifically chose not to do that. A, because I have a very strict rule about never meet your heroes. You know, when Neil Peart passed in 2020, it was just this massive blow to, you know, to everybody, from, you know, the rest of the band right on down to all the fans. You know, it was something that really pulled the rug out from under a lot of people. And when I was, you know, when I was writing the book, it really struck me how much it seems to me like, you know, Geddy and Alex and a lot of the fan base are still just very much in grieving. And I just didn't want to be some random guy pounding on their door for access, when the, you know, when basically they're in the middle of this horrible period in their lives, you know, that was very hard on them, I'm sure. And, you know, they kept it a secret that Neil Peart was sick, so they carried that with them for, you know, 3 years, and you know that does major emotional damage to you, to just, you have this person in your life, they mean so much to you, they're sick, you know, you're not going to have them for much longer, and you can't say anything about it. That had to be for those guys so damaging and so upsetting. That they couldn't really share what they were feeling. I just didn't want to. There's something in my effing life, where shortly after Neil passed, Geddy said, like, so there were these well-known drummers, like a week after the guy died, there were these well-known drummers calling him and saying, like, so can I be in the band? You know? And I was like, that's exactly what you don't do. That's exactly what you don't do. It would, you know, it would be better for my book, I guess, if I had talked to those guys, but not now, not like this, not in that context. And you know, if I never get to meet them, I'm glad I wasn't one of those people with very poor taste and when to reach out to them.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question, which is the fact that the members of Rush have experienced some incredible highs and lows personally and professionally. Was there one particular moment that you found especially moving to write about in your book?
The part came up where I had to write about Neil's first daughter passing away,
Oh, that's
and
such a
then
sad story.
it's horrible, you know. I certainly don't know if it were me how I would respond to that, you know. But as I was writing the manuscript, like getting closer and closer to that part, I was really kind of worried about it because it was like you have to handle that very sensitively. You have to really dial back as much as you can, and you know, be as respectful as you can be during that part of it. And the closer I got to it, the more scared I was of it. But once I got to it and it was time to write it, that became the easiest thing in the entire book to write, because I was the most emotionally invested at that point. And I realized I actually had quite a bit to say about it. And I would say between that and when he got remarried and when, you know, Planet Olivia, the baby was born. That, you know, like that whole bit. I realized in some ways, like that was the reason I wrote the book. Was part of it was expressing, you know, grief, sadness, joy for what Neil Peart had been through. And for me, that turned out, I realized at the time, that was the whole emotional underpinning of the book. Between that and just my fandom, I realized that was the whole point. That was why I wrote the book, which I didn't realize until I was doing it. I mean, I was not a parent when all that stuff happened. 1996, 1997, I was in my 20s, unmarried, no children. And even then, it was like, my God, that's like the most horrible thing I can possibly imagine. And I was like a free single dude at the time, with no marital or any other kinds of attachments like that. And even as like a single moron, I was able to tell that that's like maybe the worst card that can be dealt to you. So even, I, who had no sensitivity towards or understanding of that type of a thing, I was able to clearly see that is horrible. That is absolutely horrible that anyone should have to go through something like that.
Well, I want to get back to the music. How do you see Rush's role in shaping the prog rock genre? Are there other bands that you could compare them to in that realm?
There are a lot of bands that came later that were doing sort of what, progressive rock mixed with hard rock metal, like Dream Theater is a good example. But they Rush came a little too late, I think, to be part of, like that original English wave of prog rock, like Yes and King Crimson and Genesis. They said they were very influenced by that stuff, but when they came along, it was that had already kind of passed. But it's always had fans, and it's always had people who are diehards, who will show up for it all the time. So I don't know that they were really in the same in the same sort of pocket as, Genesis, Yes, all those bands that I just mentioned. But it seemed to me like, because of the time when they were working, they wanted to dabble in that somewhat, but they didn't stay with it for lots of records. They did a couple of records like that and then moved on. If anything, I think in the early part of their career, that was the time when they were sort of emulating their heroes to a certain degree. But they got tired of that after just a couple of albums, and they moved on to new things. They would dabble in a lot of what was going on around them, like synthesizers and new wave and stuff like that. And I never felt like they were doing any of it to be contemporary or to be popular. I think for them, it was more just like, okay, so here's this new wave stuff. Those instruments look like they might be interesting to play. We could maybe get some textures out of them that we haven't gotten before. Why not? Let's give it a try. They weren't afraid of new musical movements that were coming along. They saw it more, less as something to compete with, and more as something to try. Which, again, if you're an artist, if you're a creative person, it should be more about wanting to have artistic freedom and artistic opportunities than being about, our audience wants us to do 11-minute songs. You can't function in that second way. You have to always be kind of moving, and they always did. So I mean, as much as there's stuff there that you can compare to, early original prog rock, they didn't stay with it for very long. And I don't even really consider them of that movement. They were really like kind of on their own island in a lot of ways. And I never saw them as like part of this genre or part of this genre. They really were doing their own thing.
In an era where so few bands have careers lasting even a fraction of 50 years long, what do you think makes Rush so exceptional and timeless?
It's a few things. For one thing, the way they've always operated is they've always bypassed the music industry and tried to get just the music directly to the audience as much as they could. They never even got signed at first, and their first record got played because someone was doing this DJ a favor and saying, you might like these guys. That was it. There was no music industry apparatus behind them to push them or to aggressively promote them on radio stations or anything. But what always, their strength and what always happened was just the people out there just liked what they heard. And it was not contrived in any way. It was barely marketed, I would say. And they did eventually become popular anyway. But I think that's both a coincidence and an accident, because they were never trying to be popular, and they were never trying to do anything commercial. But they did things that happened to become popular. But I don't think that there was any intention on their part. To say, like, okay, so we don't hear a single on this album. We got to get something on top 40. I just don't think that was in their process at all. I'm sure they had a lot of people telling them that and saying, you might do to, get a dance hit out there or something like that, but it just, not happening.
Yeah, even the Stones did kind of a disco song in the late 70s, right? With Emotional
And
Rescue.
Rod Stewart,
Yeah.
all the people who said they would never do it, they all did it.
Well,
A year after the thing, they would never do it.
for new fans discovering Rush through your book, what do you hope that they take away from the band's story and their music?
My hope, as far as that part is concerned, is it's really, I have been struck by the fact that there has not been any decline whatsoever in people getting interested in this band. And now we're talking about kids like my son's age. He's 17. Generation Z is now lining up to get their fill of this stuff. It's brand new to them. They have never heard it before, and it's like nothing else that's out there, so it completely blows their minds. And it blows their minds in the same way that it blew my mind in the 80s, because it still is this incredibly new, unique sounding thing that you really can't compare to anything. And the musicianship, these kids who may not have musical training or anything, like, they can tell these guys can play, obviously. What I really wanted is, I have found, I'm 55 years old, and I have found that a lot of middle-aged dudes, specifically dudes like myself, 55 and up, have become sort of gatekeepers to what we consider our music, and get sort of hostile towards these young people coming in. I felt, no, actually, as one of these older people, it is my job to find a way to welcome these kids in and show them everything. Come look at everything, and my one of my most fervent hopes is that, one of these kids is like, they've heard a few songs, they think it's great. Oh, wow, okay, let me look at this book about this band. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, I didn't know that. So, sort of that kind of an experience. That's what I'm hoping for. But the music seems to be selling itself. So, my book is this kind of, it's like a, kind of like a side dish to it.
I love that. Well, it's a win-win. As we wind down here, I've got to ask you my standard exit question. What is your own personal rock and roll nightmare?
I lived it a couple of times. I used to play in bands years ago. We were not popular, and we played to a lot of empty clubs. We played in one club in Montana while all three of us had the flu and had to push like this gigantic bass speaker cabinet up this ramp that was very, very long to get it into the venue. We get everything in, and the band that goes on before us is terrible, and just the whole place empties. So we did all that with the flu and with all that, like, manual labor, and played to an empty club. That experience repeated itself throughout the entire tour.
Oh no.
So I would say a 30-day tour covering 900 miles where nobody comes to see you, my rock and roll nightmare. And that kind of was the end of my illustrious music career at that point.
Well, now you're an illustrious author, and I want to congratulate you on your book. Let everyone know that the book is
Thank
out
you.
now. Are you on social media, and can you talk about what's next? You said you're working on something. Can you give us a peek at that?
I'm on Instagram because I think, well, I maintain a professional page on Facebook also. But like you will not find me on Twitter. You will not find me on TikTok.
People are leaving Twitter in
Oh,
droves, yeah,
all the
or
toxic.
X.
Yeah, I'm oh, sorry, the platform formerly known as Twitter. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No one is calling it X, by the way. They changed it like a year ago, right? And everyone is still like, oh,
Yeah.
it's Twitter. Yeah, okay. Yes, I'm on Instagram. It's just at Dan Buxbaum. My website is notoriousbuk.com. And I'm sorry, what there was another
Oh,
question
you
after
said you
that.
were working on a book. Can you talk about it yet?
Oh, yes, I'm writing for the same publisher, Iron Maiden at 50.
Oh, nice. Well,
So,
congratulations.
oh, thank you. Yeah, this has been a great ride with these guys. This is my third book with Quarto Motor Books.
I think you put out some great work. So thank you for being here. It was really great to meet
You for
you,
having
and
me.
congrats again.
Thank you very much.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-Nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening.